And now, broadcasting live on Star Worldwide Networks, it's time for Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. If you suffer from addiction to opiate pain relievers, heroin, alcohol, or other substances, we're here to give you hope and help you overcome your addiction. Now, here's your host, Dr. Nelson.
I can't count the number of times I attended a 12-step meeting early in my recovery, where it wasn't long before someone began spouting off things like how great God is, or their lives have changed completely since they came to know God, or that they know God is doing this or that in their lives, or my least favorite, God spoke to me this morning and said, fill in the blank. At these moments, I would develop a reflexive disdain for both the individual and their message as they spoke about things of which I was unable to relate. At times, I would block out anything they said thereafter. Why would I be experiencing this strong reaction? I would ask myself. I intuitively knew that those with any devoutness in their spiritual beliefs enjoy a quality of recovery that I could not relate to. If I were honest, I would have to say that I was always somewhat jealous of these people because they had something that I wanted. In recovery, we learn to seek out those who have what we want, recovery-wise, the idea being that someone with a great quality of recovery is someone we would likely benefit from knowing, relating to, and emulating so that we too could have what they had, that thing that we intuitively find to be compelling about their attitude or insights. Perhaps one reason for my reflexive disdain in these circumstances was partly because these woo-hoo spiritual type of conversations were in stark contrast to everything I shared in the meeting up to that point, content to which I could relate nearly verbatim about others' experience, hope, and how they change. Why did these God-talking people's words turn me into such a resentful state that I would end up dissociating with the entire meeting? Were I to apply some psychology to myself, I'd probably conclude that in these moments of anger, I was engaged in projection, directing anger toward another person that was really intended toward a part of myself that I found unacceptable. Of course, the problem with projection is that when we're focused on others, we're not focused on ourselves, and we impair our ability to grow. It's always easier to criticize others than to look at ourselves.
Thank you for reading that. And for those of you just tuning in, you were listening to an excerpt of the preface to the book by Andrew Pierce. Andrew is a master level certified addiction professional, and the book is Resolving Spiritual Skepticism in Recovery. I can't read the bottom of it. Fitting the universe, putting the universe to work for you. Sorry. My name is Dr. William Nelson, and you're listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery. So I have to start by saying that this morning, probably at about 7:30, I didn't know who Andrew was, and I had no idea about his book. But he was on the schedule for today's podcast. And normally, I come down to the studio, and I haven't seen Robin for a while. So good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Doc.
Yeah, and happy holiday, happy New Year. And normally I would come in and give Robin a big hug and haven't seen her for a while. But I literally couldn't hardly put this book down because I was so intrigued by the premise. And as a doctor who specializes in the treatment of addiction, I think that our Mr. Pierce has come on to just some incredible insights. And I'm so fascinated to talk with him today and hear more about his perspective. With that, welcome, Andrew, and thanks so much for coming on today. And I really, really love what I've read thus far. And here's my perspective as to why. I have so many patients that come into me, whether it be alcohol use disorder, or right now the one that's killing people is the opiate or fentanyl use disorder. And there's so many challenges that a person needs to overcome, so many of which it's even hard to put your finger on. And very rarely do I have someone come in to my office and say, you know, I love 12-step. I love, you know, giving myself up to a higher power. And man, oh man, that's made such a difference. Because people that do that and are able to do that, they, chances are going to continue on their path to recovery. Many of the people that come into my office, I loved what you said, is you've never met anybody that's too dumb to recover, but you've met many people that are too smart to recover for their own good. And with that, I love the concept that you've discussed and, you know, the three stages of recovery and also the three most common barriers are a spiritual contempt, fear of authenticity, and a lack of our ability to change. And so with that, that's what fascinates me about your book and about your personal story. And I'm so excited to hear from you, help you, and have you help us understand your perspective. And I know there are people out there listening that are going to really benefit from what you have to share. So thank you for coming on. With that, could you give us a little kind of a Reader's Digest version of your personal struggle and then how you move past that and what led you to your career now as a very successful addiction counselor in Florida, and then which leads us to this wonderful book. So I know that's a mouthful, but.
No, I'll try to be efficient. You know, when I was, I guess the easiest way to think about it is really to start at the beginning in terms of things that probably helped to set the stage originally for my being vulnerable to addiction, in my opinion. You know, I was adopted as an infant, which really, from a practical sense, doesn't really seem to mean much, but there's always that little thing in the back of your head that, well, your own mom didn't even want you, which is a huge, attachment that people have, I think, when they're born, they connect with their mom. And so that could have been an aspect that contributed to my vulnerability to addiction. When I was, raised through my formative years, my folks were fairly judgmental. I believe one of their mantras was children are to be seen and not heard. And I was afflicted with attention deficit disorder. And so you can imagine that a lot of my behaviors fell outside of the children are to be seen and not heard range. And so the type of feedback I got was probably more, critical and ultimately causing me to, I would say, repress my true self, which has all sorts of, Dr. Gabor Mate talks a lot about the effects of repression of our authenticity. And so when I was 13 and was faced with the prospect of having a beer and smoking a joint, the effect that it had on me after years of basically feeling like I was walking on eggshells was profound. And I didn't realize that my baseline level of anxiety and stress was so high as a result of those formative aspects. So I smoked pot and drank pretty heavily and for about 4 years until I was 17. Got in some legal trouble and then went to treatment and a sober living house at age 18, where I stayed sober for 13 years. And then when I was on my 30th birthday, I gave myself permission to have a nice glass of wine. Sounds very civilized. And had an 18-year run thereafter where in the process I lost the investment firm that I had built up. My relationship with my family went through a divorce. And basically went from a lot to nothing, camping out in a abandoned home before I moved out back out to Los Angeles. And so, after 18 years, I finally of use. I finally the wheels fell off, and I went back to treatment. That was about seven, almost 8 years ago that I've been sober. And this time around, I wanted to make sure that it didn't happen again. So a friend actually said that I might be good at counseling. And so I applied to the Hazelden Betty Ford Grad School of Addiction Studies, which is arguably the best postgraduate addiction program in the in the world. Of course, I might be biased, right? I got their advanced practice degree so that I could focus on other issues that surround addiction. And as a person in recovery, I had a problem always with the spiritual aspect. I just intuitively knew that, again, like I said in my introduction, that people with some sort of devoutness seem to have an advantage over everybody else. They just, if you think about addiction as a stress response primarily, things that spirituality purports to address, resolve, decrease stress. And if you're going to take away fuel for addiction, then that can't be a bad thing. And it just bothered me. I couldn't get that aspect. And I just happened to like science and physics and things. And I was able to find a back door to spirituality with science. And that's why I wrote the book, because it was such a compelling argument that I couldn't just let it go. I was exposed to a number of aspects in my practice, meditation, for example. That had to be part of my clinical program in the treatment center that I was working at. And that's, I just started connecting the dots and ended up putting it in writing. It took about 2 years from start to finish.
Well, I really love the idea and how, it's interesting. A couple comments or observations, and I want to get your opinion. But mm-hmm. I think part of the challenge I observe with my patients is when I discovered 12-step. I think a lot of the principles don't necessarily cause them stress or, whatever, a cognitive dissonance or, an aversion. Because it's literally an aversion where they put their hands up and they say, no way. And so one of the things that I think is responsible for that reaction is their ego doesn't allow them to observe others and say, well, that's worked for them, and there may be something that I can take away from. It's kind of like that in combination with this condescension. So, it's a very, even though it's spiritually based and you give yourself up to a higher power, it's like, oh, because I've done that and you are unwilling, that somehow makes me better than you. And I think the person in recovery already suffers from shame and already has a challenge with their ego. And in order to get into that position, you have to get rid of your ego and do what you've said, get more in touch with your true self in the second stage. So is that fair to say? Does that sound like what's happening?
Well, I talk a little bit about that in Chapter 9, different sources for spiritual skepticism. And you're right, that is one. Shame is certainly one of them. Family dysfunction fosters spiritual skepticism. I mean, as a kid, who's more godlike than our parents, right? And so if our parents go to church even, but then they are dysfunctional at home, and we feel rejected by them, there's no reason why as a child we wouldn't project that dynamic on a higher power that we can't even see. And so we, as a kid, we learn to distrust a higher power, period. Other people could take a logical approach and say, well, if God cared about me, this dysfunction wouldn't occur, therefore there is no God. One nice thing about a science-based spiritual model is that it requires no trust. There's nothing, it's science. It's not judgmental. How shame fosters spiritual skepticism, as I think I point out, pathological shame that's inherent to addiction makes acceptance of a higher power challenging. The repression of the true self in all of its forms creates a lot of shame and unworthiness, giving rise to an unquestioned belief that we don't deserve happiness or even the acceptance of a higher power. Also, with shame-based personalities, any sort of religion that of which judgment is a component intuitively becomes off-limits. You know, if there's a secret handshake or some sort of code of conduct, I mean, our addiction has demonstrated that we're not able to guarantee our behavior. And so it's something, you know, the idea of a spirituality or that has anything to do with, you know, religion can be daunting to somebody like that. You know, the idea of our imperfection as a result of our experience with our addiction, our inability to guarantee our behavior, tells us that we're unworthy of connection and love to a higher power. We don't even feel worthy of forgiveness if in the context of a Judeo-Christian God. So, and then, of course, there's the fire and brimstone approach, right? Clearly, our behaviors have lined us up for the brimstone side of that equation. So there's that, right? The trust thing, lack of feeling worthy of it. Then there's the false self that, of course, just the ego, like you said. The false self in our has created sort of a protective, it served a purpose to protect our inner child from being attacked, to, you know, save us from being abandoned. We've developed sort of the ability to paint a picture so that we can get what we believe is love, but that same false self has created a situation where we can't be honest. We spent so many years or sometimes decades painting a picture, we forgot who we even are. And so we don't feel worthy of the, you know, actual validation that could come with connection with a higher power. So there are a lot of different reasons why, you know, people in early recovery or addiction have a hard time with spirituality. But even statistically, you know, there is a benefit. I point out in the book that intuitively I felt that folks with some sort of devoutness had an advantage. I didn't even think to look it up until like a month ago or something. I'm like, oh, I wonder if there's studies on this. And sure enough, in fact, their outcomes are far better for those who have adopted essential spirituality.
Okay. And spirituality, but not necessarily 12-step, or is the study?
I think, you know, 12-step program requires a belief in a higher power, right? Some sort of something bigger than ourselves. You know, the clinical model that I've basically developed, that I call it the unified theory of recovery, basically. There are really two prime directives for us. One is to, the main one is to fulfill our true potential, which is something that we can't really do when we're in active addiction, and something that we actually usually don't believe that we can accomplish as a result of the learned helplessness that we've experienced as a result of addiction. The other idea is that there is some sort of benevolent higher power, and so I choose to adopt sort of an Eastern perspective that involves consciousness and the universe. And, you know, the idea that there's some sort of divine intelligence, if you will, that's woven into the nature of reality that wants us to be happy and wants us to fulfill our true potential. There's no judgment in that concept, so it's easier to adopt.
Yeah, and I like the idea that you proposed, is that basically the unified field is basically a medium or the ether through which divine intervention, love, infinite love and gratitude flows from the creator or this higher intelligence to the individual. And it allows that person to realize there's no separation. And yet,
yeah, it's quite literally the means, the vehicle, the medium, the mechanism by which, you know, prayer and the communication works with
conduit,
the higher power,
so to speak, where it's the conduit or the technology through which science and high energy physics is now confirmed that this is factual and this is actually occurring, and it allows it's kind of separate and distinct from our spiritual beliefs. So whether you are Buddhist or believe in, you know, a Judeo-Christian God, or the higher intelligence is irrelevant because it still uses that same unified field through communication to allow this to occur. And that's where the miracles happen, and that's where transformation's possible. So that part is really cool. You're able to...
Yeah, it's compatible with any higher power. You can plug in any higher power that you want, and it still works. It's not at odds with any spiritual model that exists, including the 12 steps, I would add.
Yeah, and that part's really exciting because I have so many people that say, well, you have Bill Maher or people do religiosis or whatever. He did that thing, kind of doing his best to discredit and kind of bring to the forefront, in his opinion, the falsity of God and Christianity. And yet your book is able to marry the two, and, your belief, whether it's in a Judeo-Christian God or, just a intelligent higher power or Gaia or whatever, how you want to name it, and the traditions and the basic philosophy and the tenets of that religion, it's separate from this technology that's consistent and provable through, science. So that's super cool. And I think that might be a good segue into maybe you describing how how I call it an ether or this unified field works, and maybe describe that to people that may not be as familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me just to back up one second, because I think this is an important point that relates to your last comment. First of all, I think that this whole idea started out when I had watched a documentary on the placebo effect, right? And so, the placebo effect is responsible.
Is that the one by Dispenza?
Yeah, exactly. You Are the Placebo, I believe, is the name of the lecture.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, there's a reference to an article in the book. By the way, I'll get to that later. But anyway, the placebo effect. So the idea is, for instance, with medicine, there's when they're testing out a new medicine, they give one group the medicine, they give a control group no medicine, but they don't know that they're not getting it. And the placebo effect is responsible for up to, approximately 75% of the outcome at times of the people that actually got the medicine. And right, so there is something that mind over matter, if you will. So, with that in mind, it was the effect that I wanted to get with spirituality really has very little to do with the epistemological. I'm not making an epistemological argument that God exists or doesn't exist, because frankly, as part of the system, we can never truly be objective. All we can do is create a sufficiently compelling circumstantial argument. And that's what my book proposes to do, is to basically pile on so much data and evidence that it becomes pretty much a foregone conclusion. And I explain how that works. Also, the book itself is maybe 260 pages, something like that. But at the beginning of the book, before the table of contents, there's a link that goes to a digital resources vault that contains about 26 hours of videos. So as you go through the book, you run into a little icon, and then it might say like 3.1. So you go to the website. You find chapter 3, video 3.1. It might be a TED Talk. It might be a Cosmos type of documentary. But there's 26 hours of supporting material in the videos, which the book kind of connects the dots and interprets those things. So it is a standalone entity, but it helps if you have subject matter experts providing the information instead of me, just some guy that nobody knows from a hole in the ground. So there's that. Now, getting to the model itself, the way that I like to describe the field, or what used to be called field theory, although it's not a theory anymore, it's a fact, is that Overall, we take a reductionistic approach. We start with, you know, things that we can see, the table in front of me, ourselves, our computers, our coffee, what have you. And we break things down. The question was that started this whole thing is, what is the most fundamental aspect of the universe? And back in the old days, they used to think it was atoms, which they thought were solid things. And as our technology improved, we realized that atoms were made of parts, electrons and nuclei. And we even developed ideas about how they looked and how they interacted. And eventually we got down to the subatomic particles and things like the components of atoms, for example. And then we started looking at how those things acted. So in a nutshell, the three subatomic particles that comprise everything that we see, pretty much ourselves included, and the universe, are what are called up quarks, down quarks, and electrons. So up quarks and down quarks make up the nucleus of atoms. A proton has two up quarks and one down quark. A neutron has two down quarks and an up quark, but they're quarks, right? And then the electrons are just electrons, and they fly around. So we figured that out, and that model worked for a long time, but people were having trouble explaining, you know, where these things came from and how they acted. And somebody, it turns out in a nutshell that protons and, you know, quarks and so on are actually epiphenomena. In other words, they're derivative of a more fundamental aspect, component of the universe called fields. It's energy. In other words, and the way that they figured that stuff out is somebody asked the question, when you look at an atom, for example, a hydrogen atom, and you've got your nucleus with your proton and neutron, if you blew that up to the size of a golf ball, the radius of the potential electron cloud around it, just the radius, would be a mile and a half. So you've got this golf ball size nucleus and then a 3 mile diameter possible electron cloud where this tiny electron could be at any given time with a helium atom. And somebody asked, well, what about all that empty space in between the atoms? What is it anything? It can't be nothing. And so over time, quantum field theory was developed. It was, in fact, energy, which, when excited to a very specific number of what are called mega electron volts, a subatomic particle would appear. So the fundamental element, if you will, of the universe was the fields, these 17 fields, only three of which produce the things that we see visibly, including ourselves. That everything was derivative of these fields, all the subatomic particles, all of the atoms, and then the molecules, and so on. So that's how field theory came about. And in part one of the book talks about how addiction works and how it makes it difficult. The etiology of addiction makes it difficult for people to buy into a higher power. Part two of the book talks about the science behind, you know, field theory and its implications for spirituality and how perfectly field theory fits into spirituality and the idea that, for instance, we have, you know, there is such thing as mind over matter. You know, consciousness is energy, and it's all consistent with the field model, which has been demonstrated. Every experiment ever done to either confirm or disconfirm field theory has validated it. So it's not conjecture, it's science, and it fits perfectly with spirituality. And we can leverage that to, you know, to our benefit in terms of all of the benefits that come with adopting a spiritual perspective.
Wow. So for people out there listening, that may have been lost by, you know, the technical accuracy of your description of, you know, how these elemental, you know, the quarks of quarks, how they relate to science and the field theory, all that. How can you take that and put it into a practical perspective where they're like, oh, I get why this guy's talking about that. Is it the fact that conscious thought will actually change the outcome of this energy field? Where I know,
yes, exactly.
Usually, yeah. So is that?
Let me explain how that works.
I think that's where the rubber meets the road. Yeah, perfect.
Sure. So I was doing some research, there's this experiment that used to baffle physicists for years. It was called the double slit experiment. And the question was, you know, whether particles are the most fundamental elements, like an electron or a photon, were matter, or were they in fact energy? Because sometimes they acted like matter, and sometimes they acted like energy, like waves. And it's a little difficult to explain this without. Yeah, go ahead.
But another way that they talked about that, is it a particle or a wave of,
exactly.
of frequency, or whether or not it's Newtonian physics, where your Newtonian physics is basically pool balls on a pool table, and if one hits the other one, it's predictable and it's physical and it's observable. Where the other, you're talking about Heisenberg or the Schrodinger.
There are wave functions, probabilities.
It's a wave, and sometimes it acts like a physical and physical element, and then other times it acts as an energy wave. Is that what we're talking
right.
about?
Yeah, and they were trying the wave particle duality, and this was a thing that was stumping people for a long time. But interestingly, the solution opened the door to the idea of consciousness and how it can have a material impact on reality. And what they did was they set up an experiment, and they took an electron gun. And then they put a plate with two slits in it next to each other, vertical slits. And on the other side of that, they put a screen that detects electrons. So when an electron hits the screen, it leaves a mark. And they initially shot the electron gun through the two slits. And you would think that if they were particles, of course, there would be two bars worth of electron strikes on the screen behind that apparatus. But what was interesting is when they shot the electron beam through the two slits, it created what's called an interference pattern, which the implication is that they went through as waves. And if you would imagine some water slapping up against two slits, on the other side of the two slits, there would be sort of a cone that came out with waves going through there. And at some points, the waves from the two slits would either cancel each other out or they would accentuate each other. And then when they would hit the wall, it would leave sort of a zebra, what's called an interference pattern, where when the waves accentuated each other, it would leave a mark. And when they canceled each other out, there would be nothing. So it created a zebra sort of interference pattern, with the greatest intensity being in the center of the screen and then getting lesser and lesser as they go out to the sides. So the folks with the electron gun said, okay, well, maybe the electrons are interfering with each other, bouncing off of each other, so let's shoot one through at a time. And so they would shoot one electron through at a time. They would look at the screen. It would light up where it hit. And after a couple of hours, they were amazed to see that even when they shot one electron through at a time, it still created an interference pattern. Yet there was nothing to interfere with, and so that really baffled people. So they got one of the physicists said, well, tell you what, let's look at the slits, and we'll be able to tell which slit it went through. And that way we can figure out what's going on here. Is it going through both at the same time? How is that possible? It clearly was a piece of matter, an electron, when it left the gun, and it clearly was an electron when it hit the screen. What's going on? So they put an apparatus where they could see through the slit, see at the slits which slit the electron went through when they shot it through one at a time. And amazingly, when they looked at the screen behind it, all of a sudden it was just two bars that were line of sight, as though it was matter going through from the gun. The electron was an electron. It was not energy. It went through and struck in a line of sight. So there was a clump pattern, two bars. So whenever they would look and observe what slit was going, what the electron was going through, it would be a clump pattern. When they didn't observe, it reverted back to an interference pattern, which was the implication, of course, being that the observation of the system itself had an impact on the outcome. And nobody could figure that out for the longest time. And so what quantum field theory did was when that came along, all of a sudden we were able to realize that not only was the system itself derivative of the fields, the electron gun itself, the electrons, the plate, the splits, the two slits, the bar that the plate that held the two slits, and the apparatus, but actually we as the observer, when we observed it, our consciousness of the system had an impact, and we are made of the exact same fields. We're derivative of the same fields as the system. In other words, we incorrectly perceived ourselves as being separate from the system, but it became clear after the advent and understanding of quantum field theory that the fields were going through everything, including ourselves, and that our consciousness, which consists of energy, played a role in the outcome. And so that's when the light bulb went on and we realized that there is such thing as mind over matter. In my book, one of the videos is of a lecture of people that set up this same double slit experiment in a laboratory. And it wasn't about proximity. They had people from all over the world that would log on to the internet and they would meditate on the outcome as though they were observing the screen, and it would have a material impact on the statistically significant impact on the outcome. And so it didn't matter where you were, you could have this effect on the apparatus in the lab. So, you know, our version of that is you're just thinking about somebody and then they send you a text, you know, right. They are part of the very same system. And ironically, perhaps they use the electromagnetic field to send a message, even though they were just thinking about you. So when you start looking at the world that way, and the implications for recovery are quite remarkable. First of all, there is such thing as mind over matter. And so it gives us hope. One of the things that I do in my clinical practice as part of my clinical model is what's called the magic wand thought experiment, where I give clients obviously it's not a magic wand, but an imaginary magic wand, they have to come back to me with an idea of what their ideal world would look like if themselves and their world would look like if they could have it any way they wanted it. And, number one, it reveals a lot of pathology as to what some of their unquestioned limiting beliefs are, both about themselves and how the universe works, which gives us plenty of fodder to work on. It also reveals, cognitive distortions that they might have, which give us something to work on. But overall, once we develop this idea of what they truly want, we're able to use meditation and adding the aspect of emotion, which is something that Joe Dispenza does in a lot of his work. We start seeing little synchronicities, where we realize the universe is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, right? That's one of the promises. We start realizing that God is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. The barometer by which where I'm able to measure my quality of spirituality is to the extent to which I can relate to the 12 promises of AA. There are about 6 or 7 of them that are directly connected to a spiritual sense. Our ability to navigate situations that used to baffle us, relationships, those types of things, when we recover our authenticity, we're not confused anymore about that. So, when we start realizing that there is such thing as mind over matter and we have a little bit of control over, our reality, that's an empowering position. That's not a powerless position. And it increases our confidence and decreases our stress. And all these things remove, it increases our sense of connection. You know, once you understand quantum field theory, you understand that we are literally all connected through the fields. And so we're not as isolated. And so when you really understand quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, you're never really quite the same. And as people start practicing it, you know, and the Eastern philosophies, this visualizing what we want our life to be like, and they start seeing results, that just reinforces their level of belief that maybe there is some there. And it becomes an obsession, regaining our authenticity, asserting that, having experiences that reaffirm our new identity as somebody who, you know, what we want to be instead of who we were. All these things conspire, and they're all made possible by developing a sense of belief in what's scientifically proven to be the case. And that's what my book's about.
Well, and so what I also gather from that is it allows someone to overcome their belief that it's impossible for them to change. And it's like, well, as much as I want to, I'm not able to change, and it's impossible for me to get where I want to be. And so if I can kind of make sense of in a practical way about what you've just described, is the ability for a person to either articulate or visualize their future, the fact that
their
they can
self.
Do that, that's their ideal self and their true self, obtaining their potential as a spiritual being. So we're a spiritual being having a human experience. And the ability to visualize or articulate that means that's one of the multitude of possible outcomes. And so if they put energy behind that with thoughtfulness, love, and this expectation, the unified field theory, just as when they were observing the electron, deciding where it was going and what it was doing, just the observation or the intention of our consciousness is like a magnet drawing them to that desired outcome. Is that what we're saying and how you use
that's a brilliant analysis. Yeah, in essence, we become co-gods, for lack of a better term, which is a pretty strong assertion, but it's also accurate. When you look at the concept of now, right, the present moment, and you realize, you know, going back to that golf ball size nucleus, and that the field of possibility of, you know, the 3-mile diameter range of possibility of how that atom, where that electron could be, that plays a role in, you know, because our reality is comprised of subatomic particles, right? And so at any given point in time, there's what physicists refer to as the superposition of all possible realities. In other words, there's nothing concretely written in the present or the future until we create it with our conscious awareness. And one of the implications of that is that we all have our own local reality. But at any given point in time, all possible realities exist, according to the mathematics behind quantum mechanics. And so all of them, that means an infinite number. There's a number where there's one reality where, you know, I'm using one different word than I did for the rest of this entire conversation. There's a reality where I have a lizard head, right? There's a reality where my coffee in my hand is in the other hand. All of them, the infinite is a lot, right? So all of them are possible realities. It's up to us in our consciousness to basically create our own reality. And physics, you know, quantum mechanics makes it quite clear that that is what we need to do. And so one of the things about that is, even stockbrokers have to say this, is that past performance does not guarantee future results. And so one mistake that people in early recovery make who don't understand this dynamic is they believe that they have this limited, signature of possibility moving forward. They incorrectly view their future prospects based on their past experiences. But when we really internalize this concept, we realize that in order to have a new, and Dispenza says this, in order to have a new personal reality, we need to do it as a different personality. And so when we meditate
can I interrupt at that point? Because sure. A couple of things. I cannot believe this, but we're coming up towards the end of the interview. And I'm going to ask you to come back, if you would, because I think this is really important to understand the basis and the foundation upon which your clinical practice and your perspective is. Yeah, I think many people, if they adopt that belief and understand its value, I think it would be hugely beneficial to them and for me personally to kind of make that transition into how you incorporate that in your clinical work. And I know you do a lot of really good work one-on-one, you have group, you have things done virtually online, and I want to be able to get into that. But I wanted to make one quick comment about that. Sorry for interrupting.
Sure. But, no, by all means. That is, I didn't realize the time. Time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, I know. And I'm so fascinated by your insight. And it's really, your IQ has got to be up there. Because I'm telling you, you have a really strong grasp of the science and the clinical application. And that's the part I want to emphasize on our next talk, if we could do a part two. But back to our 12 step. Part of the problem that I perceive in light of what you just said is that when you start out with AA, you say, my name's blank, I'm an alcoholic. So that's a thought, that's what you're creating, and why are you affirming that which you don't want to be as in your future? And so I think that's the part that I have people say really resist. So we got just a couple minutes, and if you could just really maybe in a 30-second talk about that, and then tell people how they can learn more about you, maybe reiterate the title of the book and maybe your website. And then if we could, Andrew, I'd love to schedule you back for a second part two, so we can kind of go where the rubber meets the road. But we got about just 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, you know, when it comes to 12-step meetings, I mean, I say, I'm Andrew, I'm an alcoholic, really because it conforms with the social norms, you know. And yeah, I am vulnerable to relapse, I think. That part of me is going to be there. But, with the UTR clinical model that I created, the Unified Theory of Recovery, which is sort of a play on words there, it substitutes power where there once was powerlessness. You know, when we admitted to God that our lives, we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Identifying one of the unquestioned beliefs about who we are is our identity, right? And so we can come from it from a position of weakness and powerlessness, or we can really take responsibility for our future by understanding and internalizing the nature of reality to our benefit. And so I don't spend a lot of time really, strongly identifying as an alcoholic. I think that it's important to acknowledge my past so that I never go back there again.
Okay.
So there's that. Okay. As far as,
can you tell us how people can get a hold of you? Can you tell us how people?
Yeah,
can
the best way to reach me is my website. It's quite simple. It's my name. It's my middle initial, andrewgpierce.com. And it's got a link to, the book. People can, buy the book there. They can also get it on Amazon, by the way. It's got all 5-star reviews. It's been really rewarding watching this clinical model go nuts. I'm developing a 4-day workshop based on the clinical model to get people started, which will have then follow-up weekly Zoom sessions where people can report back their findings and their experiences in implementing it. That's andrewgpierce.com. andrewgpierce.com is the way to reach me, and it's got my cell number on there, and you can call or fill out any forms you want, and I'll get back to you.
Awesome. So, Andrew, thanks so much for coming on today, and I want to get you back on. I'll have Stephanie reach out to you or your publicist, and then I'd like to get you on so we can get to, like what I said, rubber meets the road. This is Dr. William Nelson. Thanks so much for everybody listening. Thanks to Andrew, and thanks, Robin, for facilitating this discussion. This is Dr. William
Nelson.
Thanks for
having me, Doc.
And we will talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. Listen live each week at this time or anytime 24/7 on demand at StarWorldWideNetworks.com.